And then they kicked the call off by officially announcing that we got Sig Werner from Hong Kong, one of our most esteemed alchemists, and we're going to have a great call of Sig Werner and also a raffle for $100 of Sig Werner's product. And Barry will announce that soon when Barry figures out who the raffle winner is, because there's a special way of doing that. Woohoo! So I want to welcome you to the call, buddy, Sig Werner. And why don't you start with what you started with about 10 minutes ago. And thank you for coming, and welcome to the call.
Thanks to everybody for being here. And I hope everyone will feel free to ask any questions that they have. And I will do my best to answer any and all questions. This is a very complex topic when we speak about Ormus, and we're all still learning a lot about it. And I'm involved in it every day. I'm making some kind of a product almost every day of my life, and so I'm very much 100% engaged in it. And I see miracles every day. And so I'm still just as impressed with Ormus and using Ormus and making Ormus as I was when I first started about a decade ago. So I'm hoping everyone, if they're trying to make their own Ormus, or if they want to, they will feel free to ask me any questions that they have. The way I'd like to start this discussion this morning is some of the concepts that have evolved in my, as I have learned more and more about Ormus. And as most people know, I came into Ormus as a sun gazer. And one of the things that impressed me most about Ormus was the fact that it gave to me the same kinds of spiritual feelings that I had previously experienced as an avid sun gazer. I immediately saw the connection between the two of them, and the more I do the both of them, the more I realize I'm really actually engaged in a singular thing. And one of the reasons why, when I first started selling Ormus, I didn't call it Ormus. I called it liquid sunlight. And I really thought about that a lot before I named the product. And I'm, you know, sometimes all of us, I think, have a stroke of genius. But to me, Ormus has always been liquid sunlight. I one time did a study into Einstein. I guess everyone knows who he is, a great scientist, a great theorist in physics. Sole motivation, as he evolved more and more, a concept of how God actually created all that we have, all that there is. He was interested in finding the essence of creation. He wanted to know how God actually created all the elements. And that was part of his theoretical thinking when he came up with the theories of relativity and the special theory of relativity. And I've often thought about that as I work with Ormus. And I think that probably if Einstein was still alive today, he would be very much into Ormus, and also light. And I don't know whether most people know it or not, but Einstein was never awarded a Nobel Prize for his work with relativity. He was working with thermal heat and light. And if you want to read something interesting, read about what is light. Einstein had his own ideas about it, and every great physicist, I think, from the beginning had a theory of light and what it is. Well, I believe that from the stars in all the heavens, and from our own local sun, there is matter coming to us, but it is not yet matter. Now, if you want to speak about it in religious terms, I think all of the great religions talk about how we come from spirit, we sojourn on earth in a physical existence, and then at some time, when our time is up, or when we have done what we're supposed to do, then we are to return to spirit, okay? And I believe that exactly the same thing happens with the light that comes to us from the celestial spheres that are by the billions. There's some 20 or 30 million tons or billion tons of cosmic dust that come to the earth every year. And I don't hear the people who are, you know, the geologists really thinking or saying or writing about where all this dust comes from. They just know that if they dig down into the earth is in layers. You know, there may be 2 feet of this and 5 feet of that, and then there's rock, dead rock, harder rock, until they get eventually into a molten core in the center. Well, it's my theory that all of this physical earth that we have originally came as light. And just as a religion will teach you that we come from spirit, we enter physicality, and then one day we will return to spirit, I like to think that Ormus is doing the same thing. I believe that when the sun radiates and when the stars radiate, and each of the stars is a sun, some big ones, some little ones, and there are planets. Every planet has a frequency. Every planet has a radiance of sorts. But when the light comes from these heavenly bodies, it comes in the form of a beam of light. And that beam of light can either be in wave form or particle form. And so as it comes down through space, it is undergoing an entropy, just like every living thing does. It declines. It gets heavier. It gets slower. And as light comes to the Earth is actually being bombarded with infinitesimally small particles, and these particles are the entropic effect of light, and this is what is called dust. Now, there's probably 25 or 30 places in the Bible that talks about dust. From dust we came, and to dust we shall return. It's not necessarily talking about the dust on the earth or the physical form of it. That dust originates as light. And as it changes from light into a physical form, a particle, that, I believe, is Ormus. Now, the scientists will tell you that the light from our sun is generated by nuclear fission. And the elements they name are hydrogen, and that hydrogen is then broken or fused to become helium. So the sun is said to be a hydrogen-helium nuclear process. And if you look on any periodic chart, you'll see that the first element is hydrogen. It has one electron. It has one proton. It does not have a nucleus or a neutron. Then you get to helium. It's the fusion of two hydrogens to become a single element. And it's my belief that hydrogen is the building block of all other elements. One element adding another electron and being balanced by existing dust to form a nucleus, a neutron, and a proton, then becomes the next element. add one more electron or hydrogen ion, and it becomes the next element. So I believe that everything we have comes from the one. This is both a physics belief, but it's also a spiritual belief. And I believe that oneness is the first step down from spirit. But when you look at it the other way, when you take a heavy metal like gold, like silver, like rhodium, or like iridium, or any of the platinum group of metals, and you then break it down from its collective or molecule, the metallic molecule, which is made up of many atoms of that particular type, like gold, 36 or 39 actual gold atoms fused together, bonded together to become the metallic form. When we make ormus using the David Hudson method, what we're actually doing is we're breaking that gold down from a molecule of gold, which makes it metallic, into single atoms of gold. And when you do that, it takes a tremendous amount of hydrogen to do it. And what we find is these tiny particles, these tiny atoms of that metal, be it gold or iridium or rhodium, once they are separated out of the metallic form and become what is called a non-metallic metal, it's still a gold atom, but it then becomes a very excitable non-metallic atom that collects hydrogen like a sponge. In other words, it loves hydrogen. And when we are making ormus, the reason we add sodium hydroxide is to give enough hydrogen to these tiny particles for them to suck it in, and it's some of them collect 600 times their weight in hydrogen. Some of these tiny atoms collect 800 or 900 times their weight in hydrogen, but it is actually the hydrogen that makes a single atom of one of these metals reveal itself as a particle of ormus. And that's what floats to the bottom or sinks to the bottom when we're precipitating ormus. These tiny atoms, absent the hydrogen, they're frightened little things, and they seek refuge into crystalline salt is what they love a lot, but I'm sure that they're hiding other places as well. When they lose their hydrogen, they go back into hiding. It is hydrogen that fulfills them. These single ions of hydrogen, and those single ions of hydrogen is the physical form of sunlight. It started out as spirit, as light. It comes to earth over a great journey. In that journey, it slows down. And as it slows down, it comes here, and then it builds upon each other until they create the 100 or so elements that we have, depending upon the heat, the pressure, the conditions that they find themselves in. Some areas produce a lot of gold. Some areas produce rhodium. Some areas produce copper. But those are conditional things that happen to the collected hydrogen ions and ormus as it changes from metal to metal. That's my theory. I believe it's correct. When we ourselves, as human beings, come to Earth, we come first as a spirit. We are thrust into a physical body. When we die, the spirit will leave again. It will return to the light from which it came originally. From dust thou art, until dust thou will return. And so I believe that the same trip that we take sojourn on earth, every other physical thing, element, does the same exact thing. And so, to me, just a higher, re-spiritualized form of matter. Barry uses the term, it's the bridge between matter and spirit. And I believe he's absolutely correct on that. I believe that what we have is we take a degraded spirit, which is in the form of a physical element, and we can resurrect it into its finer, purer, more spiritual form. And when I deal with oneness every day, I have to be very careful that my attitude is one of clarity, and that I take on a rather spiritual deportment in my activities, and that I begin with a bit of meditation, because I believe that the oneness is much better when you do that. I think it's possible for anybody to take some salt and make a bit of oneness. But as I have done it over and over so many times, I don't like to think that I'm getting better at it, but what I think is I actually bring more of the spirit into it when my intention is correct and when my attitude is right. And I believe this is the one thing that separates, say, a chemist from an alchemist. You know, I mean, the scientists will tell you that there's no such thing as alchemy. Well, I can tell you, as both someone who has dealt in science and as one who has dealt in alchemy, that there is a lot of difference. And an alchemist has to take a lot more concern for what he's doing and how he's doing it, and the intention he has, the attitude he has when he conducts his experiments, because all of these affect the amount of illness that a person gets. I've had my down days and make illness, and I get so much. I've had really inspiring spiritual days where the yield of the illness is far greater. Now, a chemist would say that's impossible. You do the same process, you get the same result. It's not true in alchemy. In alchemy, you can get a different result. And that difference is the spiritual connection that the human being has with the physical matter. Because actually there's really life in that matter as well. It's moving, it's alive, it's radiating, and there's a connection between a radiating spirit of a human being and the radiating spirit of an element. And when they're in harmony with each other, miracles happen. And I believe that is actually how all the miracles happen. I mean, we speak of the great avatars of all the various religions having participated in miracles. And I believe it is because they have a spiritual connection with the actual physical elements of the earth. I mean, you know, they can get water from a rock, or they can cause a tree to grow or cause a tree to wither and die simply by their thoughts. They sometimes become so common to me that I don't even recognize them that way, as I would have, say, 15 or 20 years ago. I mean, sometimes when I'm up on my roof and I'm sun gazing, I will actually say, I mean, I talk to the animals, and birds seem to like me. And they don't seem to be afraid of me. So when I'm up on my roof, you know, there's some wires nearby, and there's some trees on both sides. And I will say good morning to the birds. the birds seem to come. I mean, they fly in from all over and land in these trees next to me. Or they'll land on the wires right above my head. And so, to me, that's a miracle. I've even, at times, called in specific kinds of birds. I mean, what I say is, well, I'd like to see some doves this morning, and a pair of doves will come and land near me. I don't know how that happens, but it happens. In making Ormus, though, you know, I can tell when my attitude is not right because it doesn't work for me. I mean, let's say about a month and a half ago, you know, I had the sale going on of the 2-for-1 special on the red gold. And I really, you know, I had a daughter that's in the States now, and she's been there for almost 2 months now, and it was a period of time where I was really trying to get a lot of stuff done. I had two university classes that I was involved in teaching and marking all the examinations and assignments. I was really pressed for time. And yet at the same time, I was trying to make this red powder gold. And I tell you what, I messed up more times than I can imagine or want to think about, because it would not come out right. I tried again and again and again. And, you know, we're dealing with a very expensive substance here. And it's not that that the gold is lost. It's not, because even though it doesn't turn red, I mean, I had it turning black, I had it turning blue, I had it turning purple, I had it turning, some of it went all the way to white, never went through the color phase of red. And then I had to stop and think, what is the problem here? And the problem was me. It's not the elements. It's my attitude that I was bringing to, because I was really rushed on a lot of things, and I was trying to do too many things at once, and I wasn't spiritually clear. And so in the making of Ormus, when I say there's a miracle, sometimes when this stuff turns black, I have to... And I think this is also God's signal to an alchemist. Your gold has a black form. It's called a black crow to an alchemist. It's a black crow phase. And I think that's a signal to us, you know, hey, you're not right. You can dissolve this gold. It will turn a brilliantly bright yellow liquid. But then when you bring it closer and closer to the white powder, it will go through a phase of a bluish color, and then it will turn to a more purple, and then it will go to red, and then eventually it will go to white. Well, I'm not getting all those beautiful colors. I was getting mostly black each time I was doing it, and that was God's signal to me that you are not right, so it's not going to work for you. That people who make Ormus at home, they get a less of a yield or a greater yield or whatever, because of they're not conscious of how much effect they personally and spiritually from their own person are having upon the process. So we do affect how we do affect the elements. You know, I mean, the people say that, you know, Jesus was God because he could control the elements. You know, he could solidify water and walk on it. Or he could wither a bush. Or he could call down angels from heaven. You know, he could turn, make water, turn a rock, or make a rock turn to water, or make a rock turn to bread, or he could expand fishes. Other great avatars and prophets in the history have also been said to have done the same thing. Well, I do believe that we can control the elements, but it takes a very close connection to the creative ability of the spirit and the light within you. And if we're not if we're not working on that, then our abilities as an alchemist are not going to be as good. We have to be filled with light if we are going to imbue our work with light. If we're full of darkness, then that's the result we're going to get. If we get too involved with the busyness of the world and, you know, are not conscious of the more spiritual sides of our life, then the results we get in every phase of our life are going to be a bit darker than they might have been. And so when I speak of miracles, it's like something happens that's beyond normal. It's beyond normalcy. In other words, we get a better result than we might otherwise have gotten in the past. And I think the great separator between, say, a chemist and an alchemist is that the alchemist must realize that he is in control of the elements, but only if his spirit and his heart and his intention is correct. Sure, chemists can control elements. He can join them, separate them, derive them, these kinds of things, but it takes a physical means to do that. Whereas an alchemist, or we'll say a spiritualized or spiritual alchemist, is often able to do these kinds of things without the physical apparatus. That's the great separator. And it took me 25 years to realize that. So anybody have any questions concerning the first part of this?
Remember, if you want to ask a question, be sure that you unmute yourself first.
I'd like to ask a question.
Pardon me?
Can I ask a question?
Okay.
So I'd like to go back to the very basics of making ormus, and you were talking about the process of using sodium hydroxide and how that works. Could you review that piece again?
Sodium hydroxide is a substance where the hydrogen is very loosely bonded to the sodium. And so it gives it up very easily. And that's why most scientists use it in just about every chemical reaction that they're using if they need to add hydrogen or separate certain elements. That's why I guess we use it when we make ormus, because the readily available abundance of extra hydrogen, which is what the sodium hydroxide gives off. Now, we know that there's an interstitial lattice work inside the crystals of salt, and that's where these monatomic little ormus particles are hiding, okay? And they got there as they lost their hydrogen, okay? And so they go into this salt. So what we have to do when we make the ormus is we dissolve that salt with water, which exposes those tiny particles or monatomic atoms of single atoms of the metal, which are already in a very pure state, but they don't have any hydrogen to reveal themselves. They're already there. But for us to be able to see them, they have to collect all that hydrogen from the sodium hydroxide, which has also been dissolved in water. I mean, sodium hydroxide on its own is a solid. But when you dissolve it in water, then mixing the sodium hydroxide with the salt water, the chemical reaction is the hydrogen separates itself by means of the water from the sodium, the sodium goes with the chloride or chlorine in the salt to become saltier, and then the little ormus element or monatomic particle collects extra hydrogen, and then it precipitates to the bottom.
Yes. So I'm saying the N-state particle collides with the hydrogen, and that's what the precipitate is. It's N-state and hydrogen. Is that right?
The precipitate is mostly hydrogen with a little bit of single monatomic elements grasping and holding and bonding to all of that hydrogen. I mean, we're talking about single atoms here. You cannot even see an atom with the highest microscope you got. I mean, the most powerful microscope on the planet. You cannot see an atom. They are very infinitesimally small. But when they collect 900 times their weight in extra hydrogen, that's what makes it white. And that's what makes it fall down to the bottom as a precipitate.
How do you know that they're monatomic? How do you know that they
are? Yeah, I understand. I don't think it is actually monatomic either.
Oh.
But, I mean, that's what most people are thinking it is. It's actually it's a boson or a diatomic form of that element. But to keep it simple, I often use the term single atom. But that atom is like elongated. It's not like a regular atom like you see on the symbol of the Space Administration or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think atoms look like that. They come in many various shapes.
Have you observed them intuitively?
Pardon me?
Have you observed them?
Did you repeat
intuitively
that?
Intuitively or using scientific instruments?
I have never observed them actually physically. I sometimes sense them when I'm in my little laboratory, or I'm working with a particular element. I can sense that element, but I mean it's not like I can describe it.
Sorry to go back to the same subject, but I think you've finally taken us to what Ormus is, in that you're stating that it's the M-state particle that's grasping onto the hydrogen, and that's the precipitate that we get. But I'm confused as why the M-state particle is not hydrogen, because you were stating that when light comes from the sun, it's hydrogen. So what is M-state? Is M-state actually the dust?
I can barely hear your question, but I think what you're asking is, if it starts with hydrogen and it then becomes a single atom of some metal, how can it be hydrogen again, right?
Well, I'm thinking, yeah.
It's hydrogen because it remembers. I think it remembers from whence it came. And I think that's the same yearning that we have in our human hearts, is that we know we came from somewhere, we know we're a stranger here, and one day we're going to have to go back to where we came from. But I believe that, you know, through entropy, which is the slowing down, the separation from, the decline of light into matter, or the decline of spirit into matter, that is a process of dying. Okay? And I believe that you can resurrect these elements and bring them to a higher state, which is called exotropy. The reverse of entropy is called exotropy. And that's nothing more than resurrection. In a religious sense, when we speak about the physical body dying, but the spirit going on, or continuing to live, we'll say. I believe that all the elements have that same kind, you know, it's no different. There is life in a form of movement in all that there is in creation. And I believe that we will work with Ormus. We're very close to creation here. We are creators. We are exercising a certain amount of control over the elements, which alchemy has always been, alchemy has always been a spiritual art. It cannot be conducted without the spirit. Otherwise, it's just chemistry. Did that answer your question, Melanie?
Yeah. So the active ingredient in Ormus is actually the M-state particle, or the hydrogen, or together is what creates the health benefits and spiritual benefits for it.
I think it's just a bulk of them because, as I understand it, the little particles of the diatomic form, the monatomic form, the balsamic form of the element is enlivened. With the addition of hydrogen, it gives it new life. It gives it light. I think it's very, very light.
Yes.
Wonderful. Any other questions?
Can you talk about the sun being conscious or being alive?
Oh, yeah, okay. I don't know how to begin this, but yes, I think the sun is alive. Let's go back to the ancient Greek. When they looked up into the sky and they saw Orion the hunter, you know, the three stars in the belt and then the two shoulders and the knee. And later, actually before the Greeks, the Egyptians actually believed that when a person dies or when one of the pharaohs died, he actually took his place as another one of the stars up there. In other words, they radiated in such a great degree that they actually became a star in the heaven. Now, what form is that? We say it's a sphere, but do we really know that? And what is the reach of it? There are what we call the solar corona, which is on the surface of the sun, but we don't know what's really inside of it. No one's ever been there. And the same can be said of all the stars. What is that generating force that keeps that sun or that star alive, acting, moving, creating, radiating? What is it? Well, we call it God, I think. The ancient Viracocian people of South America that lived in the Andes and also the Essenes, they believe that they do take a place in the heavens after they die, just like the Egyptians. Just like the Egyptians believed. Now, are you going to be up there as a man, or it's just an object that's radiating? I don't know. Haven't done that yet. But we do know from the Viracochans that they could influence the sun with their own thoughts. The Essenes believe the same thing, and that is that what happened to man on Earth was a result of his thinking and his thoughts. And when that was radiated to the sun, it was multiplied and brought back down to him. So the sun does have a consciousness. It, I mean, this is my understanding as well, and I've studied most of the ancient civilizations and the religions of them. They actually believed that the sun, which was God, heard their prayers and then blessed them because of it. But he also, in addition to hearing their prayers, heard their every thought. So if they had bad thoughts, those were also magnified and brought down upon them. And so if you were a Viracocha elder or an Essene elder, you forbade anybody from going into the presence of the sun until they were clean and that their mind was pure. And they never said or even thought anything in the presence of the sun except a good thought. They greeted the sun. They felt like the sun was their friend. He was not only their God, but he was their friend. And so they spoke to him in prayer. Now, the religions that we have today are not really ultimately so different than that, except that we believe that God is some kind of great man in the sky with a long white beard and a flowing robe. Well, I don't think so. I think that same creative spark, that same spirit, is lodged in these various heavenly bodies. I think our sun is God's sun. In fact, the original theory, I mean, Christianity, for example, is a solar religion. I mean, it's based upon the sun, and originally, I mean, the word S-U-N and S-O-N are the same.
May
so
I say
God's
something?
Sun, this sun, pardon me? Hello?
May I speak about being a star? I have had a subjective experience of being a star in a diamond crystal body singing with other stars.
Yes.
So that's just a small fragment of...
Well, I don't doubt that a bit.
The body
that
I was in
well.
Radiated
now,
everywhere.
You know,
I'm sorry, I'll be quiet.
You know, it's very difficult for me to hear you, but I get the essence of what you're saying, is that you've had that experience.
Yes.
I've had a couple of miraculous experiences. I hate to tell people about it. I usually don't, and I don't think I will this time, but I've been out there, too. Okay? I have had those experiences where I was looking down on the earth. So I know that happens, and you can see that it's all connected. I mean, when you're out there, and I'm not talking about, you know, anything that's heebie-jeebie or wild or weird. When I go, I take my scientific mind with me also. But there's a lattice work in the heavens. And it's all connected, sun to sun, star, and there are levels out there. There are these definite dimensions that are there. And the more you proceed to the center, the more powerful the radiance. You know, one of my daughters, the seven-year-old one, said, how many heavens are there? And I said, I think there's about nine. And she said, well, how do you know that? And I said, because I've seen a few of them. And if you read the Quran or the Bible or some of the Greek mythology or some of the Roman theology, you see that these very spiritual prophetic beings that lived in those things, they talked about visiting the third heaven or the seventh heaven. John is in the seventh heaven. Also, Muhammad supposedly was looking down on the earth and the creation from the seventh heaven also. So, I mean, you know, I can relate to that because I've also seen that myself. And so when you speak of the sun having consciousness, you know, we are connected to the sun. We are a part of that consciousness. But our local sun is also connected to the hierarchy in the whole chain all the way back to the origin of this universe. We're a part of all of that consciousness from the very origin of it all. We are but a small part. We came down, and one day we can go back up. Does that answer your question? I mean, we're talking about a rather religious philosophical view here, and I'm not sure, but these are my personal beliefs, and my personal beliefs come from real experience. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, anyone else have any questions?
I don't have a question, but I would like to announce the winner of the raffle.
Oh, that's a good idea.
The raffle winner is Steve. I believe Steve was a winner on the last raffle, but decided he didn't want the pH meter. So he somehow happened to win this raffle. Yes.
Would you send me the details on that?
Yes.
Is it Steve? If Steve is on the line, Steve, you email me with your details so that I can send this to you. You go through the website and whatever you see there, up to $100, just let me know and you'll get it in short order.
I'll send you his email.
Okay, that's great. I don't know.
Fantastic.
Not many questions this morning.
Okay, let's have a question from the free room, if there's anyone in the free room that would like to ask a question.
Sigverda, how long does it take to make red powder gold?
You know, it depends upon the celestial movements to some degree. I normally tell people it takes about 3 weeks. Sometimes I can do it in about 10 days. Sometimes it takes me 4 weeks. So, I mean, there's a number of factors involved. And a lot of it has to do with how much time I can spend doing it. You know, I mean, I guess we're all busy people. I'm still raising a young family, even at my age. And I still teach a few university classes. Of course, I have all the detail to deal with in Tibetan gold. And I also have now another new company that I deal with, too. So my time is I find myself very, very stretched. I do most of what I do, though, very late at night. I'm very much like the old traditional alchemist. After my children are all in bed, I usually start my alchemistry work because I deal with a few dangerous chemicals. My office and my lab is combined. But, you know, when I'm here in the daytime, I let my young daughters come in to experience and see what I'm doing. But after they go to bed late at night is when I do a lot of this stuff. And so I'm usually up until about 3 o'clock every morning doing these kinds of things, just sitting and watching and looking and, you know, mixing and dealing and meditating. And so it depends on if I'm, you know, doing it every day. Sometimes I have to wait for it to go through stages. Well, on average, I would say from 2 to 3 weeks to make the red powder. And there's about 4 processes that I have to put it through.
I have a question for you, Sigverda. Are you working on anything new that would be of interest to us?
Let me see. Well, you know, a long time ago, I have some boron. I've been working on some borons, and I think that has some very good health aspects also. I can do copper in state now too. I've been working with that a little bit, and but copper is very difficult to get to a white powder. You can get it to precipitate in a number of different colors, but to get it to the white powder, that's extremely difficult.
Even as a white powder, does it still have a kind of a slightly blue tint, or is it pure white?
Yes, it does.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it does. In fact, when I make the face and skin cream with copper,
uh-huh,
it's called a Venus Beauty. I'm actually using a bit of in-state copper in that, and it gives it a bit of a bluish tint.
Yeah, others have reported the same thing.
Pardon me?
Others have reported the same thing.
I'm looking. You know, what's surprising to me is how expensive these metals are getting now, too. You know, like this rhodium, the stuff is $6,500 an ounce. $6,500, that's a lot of money. You know, I just buy it in small quantities, but that's a very expensive item nowadays, this rhodium. But, you know, one thing I've noticed also is that, you know, they talked about the expansion or the transmutation of this stuff as you work with it as an alchemist. And that truly does happen. I mean, this gold grows up. It grows in quantity to a certain extent. I mean, I can take some of the previous and add a bit of the new, and it actually grows in volume. So, I mean, these stories you hear about the alchemists of old, you know, changing this into that and, you know, having stuff grow and become a larger quantity, a larger volume than it was. That's really true. That does happen.
Have you seen any of this stuff?
I'm trying to think. I'm not looking on anything.
Have you seen any of this stuff disappear or get out of sealed containers or anything like that?
It sometimes tunnels through.
Uh-huh.
I mean, sometimes in a completely sealed flask, the stuff will go on the outside of the glass. I don't know how it gets through the glass, but it sure does, because I can taste it, you know, and so what is that? Is it condensate? What is it, you know? And I guess it is that a type of condensate that just tunnels through the glass.
Uh-huh.
And I really don't know how it does it. I don't know if it's actually tunneling through or going through or if it's just becoming invisible and just exposing itself on the outside. But sometimes these things do not like to be contained.
Well, maybe it's just workman's condensation.
Maybe so. But yes, I've had that experience. I've also, I think I mentioned it once before, one time I was working with, I think it was rhodium, and I actually had a nuclear reaction because it fried everything electrical in my office.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I heard a crack.
Uh-huh.
And some of the glassware cracked. And then the motherboards on several of my pieces of electronic equipment just disintegrated.
Wow.
So, I mean, yeah, we're working with, when you work with some of these things, you do have to be a bit careful. I've never really hurt myself. One time if you look at the ceiling in my lab, you know, there's paint peeling off of it. That's because a time or two, this stuff has shot up, you know, all the way from the lab table all the way to the roof or to the ceiling.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I lost, you know, a couple $1,000s worth of rhodium and iridium one time because this stuff just, like a fountain, shot up to the ceiling. And I'm not sure exactly what I did at that time, but it involved, you know, heating it, and then boom, it just blew up. Luckily, it didn't get to me, but it was all over my ceiling and walls.
Oh, yeah.
So sometimes when you work with these things, you have to be very careful. Okay.
This is Susanna calling. Sigverta, how do you stabilize and preserve your ormus? I've just made it once, and I had a really powerful substance, and then I found out a couple of days later it was much more subtle. How do you preserve it?
You can recharge it. Now, when we bottle ours, we charge it using magnets in one of these blending units. I mean, a long time ago, I made one of these things back when Ron Fusen was discussing it. And I've had to replace the magnets a few times, but I always this blender. And after I take the ormus, it's already charged a bit. But then before I bottle it to send it out, I always recharge it again. So when you get it from me, it's just recently been charged. So it should retain. And then you seal it, you know. I mean, it's in glass, and then we seal it in an aluminized Mylar bag, and then we vacuum seal that, and then we wrap it in this bubble wrap. And then that bubble wrap is put inside the bubble wrap package. And then, it's really insulated inside that Mylar bag. So, I mean, I'm hoping, and I think the results prove it, that when it gets to you, it's still in a pretty charged state.
So, like other users, they also recommend tinfoil, and you're recommending aluminized Mylar. That sounds really good.
Yeah.
In other words, that's better than tinfoil.
I have this supplier up in China that makes these aluminized Mylar bags, which I've been using for years now. But once you say it's lost its charge, I think there's a couple of ways to do that. Of course, you're dealing in very small quantities, and it's best to charge it when you've got a larger quantity. But you can still rotate it in the bottle, shake it around, and activate it, but you've got to have the lid off of it, right? Or you can take it out into the sunlight and put it in a clear glass container, put it in the sunlight for a little while, because just like what I was talking about earlier, that this light coming down is actually going to become ormus. So it will actually energize the ormus that you already have when you put it in the sunlight. Now, I wouldn't leave it out there a long time. Now, I've heard said in the past that, exposing it to UV rays turns it back to metal, but I have absolutely no evidence of that ever happening. You know,
Don Nance has some assays that demonstrate that actually does happen. However, as you said, I think...
Does happen?
Yes. I think that it's important to realize that what I think is going on is that you're revving it up. If you rev it up too much, it tends to drop toward metal. As long as you don't rev it up too much, if it is not too energetic to start with, and you don't put it out in the sun for a really long time, then you know a few minutes shouldn't be a problem. Same with the blender. I recommend that people blend it one or two or 3 minutes, but not longer.
Okay.
Yeah, I usually run it for with 3 or 4 minutes. That's maximum. But.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with this sunlight business, I have actually left some out, you know, all day long, 12 hours in the bright sunlight. And And I could not feel any, there was no metallic taste. I didn't notice any. But then again, I'm dealing with the stuff. You know, I don't know what experiences other people have because, you know, what's going on with another person will affect what's happening to the product. There are both spiritual and physical things happening to that ormus. You know, they can be only physical or they could only be spiritual. Or there can be a combination of both. So, you know, what my experience is may or may not be the same as someone else's experience in dealing with the illnesses they have. And that's one of the unique and interesting mystical things about this substance that we call illness is that everybody seems to have a bit of a different experience with it or can have a different experience with it. Because it's very unique to the person. It's very unique to the user.
Or as I say, you're unique, just like everyone else.
Yeah. Just as everybody else is different from each other, the effect they have on the ormus is going to be just that difference.
I have a question.
There's another question before you.
I'm new, and I got lots of little questions, but I have
barely,
one.
I can barely hear
regarding
you.
Regarding intention, when one is making, if you're making ormus for someone particular, would you put or have your intention placed differently than if you were making a batch for general distribution?
Did you understand that, Sigverta?
Not all of it.
If you are making a batch...
Would you repeat her question to me?
Yes. If you are making a specific batch for somebody, do you put specific intention into it versus what you would make for just general purposes?
Well, I usually have that person in mind when I'm making it, yeah. So I'm supposing it does imbue that particular batch with something to do with that person. For example, I have had special requests to make product for people. And does everybody remember this woman in Canada whose companion had skin cancer?
I'm on the line right now.
She's on the list for a while.
I'm on the line right now. And he's.
You are? Margaret?
I am.
You're Margaret?
I am.
Okay, well, you know. Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to reveal any secrets. I just wanted to tell the people that, you know, Margaret ordered some of it from me. And it was outside the 2-for-1 special. But she asked me, could she still have the 2-for-1 special, so I made a special batch for her. But at the time I was making it for her, I had in mind her and her companion's plight with cancer. And since that time, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, Margaret, but Margaret has written to me a couple of times to tell me some of the results of her having used that particular batch. And she said it's really good for her. I mean, it's really helping her cope with some of the trauma and whatever she's going through. And so, yes, to answer your question, I do believe that when I do create a product or someone in as a special order, we'll say, that my thinking of that person and their situation as I'm doing it does imbue that with a certain affinity to that person.
Bless you, Siegwerter. Without it, I would not have gotten through this. Thank you.
And thank you for you answered my question.
Well, thank you, Margaret. I knew there was a Margaret on the line, but I wasn't sure it was the same one.
Oh, yeah.
Question for Siegwerter.
I must also say one more thing about Siegwerter. He sent me the rhodium and the iridium and the gold chlorides, and we used them faithfully. But it Mark is within days of a parent dying right now. He's within hours. And it didn't work. It did not work. And I think the mind has to decide to heal.
I think so, too. I think it goes back to that, you know, the person that is using the illness also has to be in the right frame of mind, and they have to believe. There are still people who use illness and say, what is this stuff? This is nothing. This is a hoax. This is, you know, this is a scam because it doesn't work. And I always tell these people, well, it doesn't work for you. Why? Because it will work for you. I've been through this, I don't know if any of you have ever had a deep bone massage, but there's a special Chinese technique. And I found this guy who's been trained in mainland China who comes to Hong Kong occasionally to do these deep bone massages, and he's got some instruments. And it's made out of bone. And what they do is, I mean, to do a scalp massage, they, you know, if you feel the scalp, you got little bumps inside under the scalp. Well, he crushes all those out. But he said, now this is going to work for you if you believe it's going to work for you. And, you know, he was singing my own song. I said, yeah, I know. I know what you mean. And, man, I'm telling you, it was the best head massage I ever had in my life. But it was because I knew it was going to work.
That's it. It's belief. The whole world is based on our belief.
Margaret is correct. Well, I mean, if you're a skeptic, it's not going to work for you.
Okay. You mentioned a little earlier about celestial influences. And in as far as your making of your Ormus, and well, it's something that makes me curious because I tend to follow astrology for gardening, and I've also tried doing it with Ormus making too. And I think Dennis will attest to this too. He's mentioned key astrological times to make your brews and whatnot. So I'm wondering how much you take stock in that, Siegfrieda.
Oh, I absolutely believe it's true because, I mean, from my own experience, if the set of the heavens is not, the setup of the heavens is not right, my work is in cannot be completed. It's incomplete. And sometimes I have to wait. You know, I mean, right now, I got an order from someone in Nevada who wanted 4 more of the red gold powder. And it's taken me over a month. It's taken me about 5 weeks to get a batch of this stuff to come out right. In fact, I've made a couple of batches, and it doesn't come out the right color. And it's absolutely due to the heavenly movements. Sometimes it's my attitude, because then it turns really dark. But if my attitude is right, it will turn shades of pink, deep purple, these kind of things. It's in the red zone. But
that's a nice pink purple. But it was much darker than it was just now. I'm sorry.
It's been very difficult to make the red powder, and that has everything to do with the set of the planets, the moon and the sun.
And also the latest I got, somewhat solidified too. It's hardened. As the other that I got 9 months ago it's still light and fluffy, and light pink. It's just I noticed quite a difference there. So.
That's true. It does affect the precipitate, the fluffy or heavy. I experience that all the time.
Now, what does the different color? Now, my red gold that I received from you is more on the purple shade and the pink shade.
Yes.
What Is there a difference then?
Yeah. I don't think there's much of a difference.
The lighter it is,
I think
that's purely
because
of
the timing. And you know, I mean, there are some people that order this quite regularly. And it's become one of our best-selling, though it's one of the most expensive, it's also one of the best-selling products that we have. And I try to be consistent to what I say, but, you know, because of celestial movements, it's not like, you know, this month it's going to turn out exactly the same next month or the month after. I remember when I first started doing this, I had a lot of problems keeping it in that red zone. I'm much better at it now, but I'm still affected timing-wise, you know, and I've had a particular problem for the past month. Since the sale went off, I've tried to make more because I've had some repeat orders. People that liked it, you know, got the 2-for-1, they want to get some more. And this past month, it goes to white, which is not a bad thing. But, I mean, the white is also good. So it's not like I'm losing it, but I believe there's a special quality in the red also that I can detect that I try to keep it in that red zone. But it does vary slightly in color all during the year. But as long as I have it in that red zone, it's, you know, I think it's acceptable.
Better red than dead, huh?
Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yes, it does.
I guess you guys heard about that American being killed up in China yesterday.
I didn't.
In Beijing?
No.
It was an American detail. The relative of one of the Olympic coaches that was killed. Some crazy guy. And it speaks of the great turmoil. My wife keeps me informed on what the Chinese sentiment is, but we saw one of the newspapers on that news in China, and it said a tourist was killed. They didn't say he was an American, and they said there was a Chinese suicide. In other words, it was like when they reported the news in the Chinese press, they didn't want to identify the guy as an American, and they didn't connect the guy that committed suicide with the guy who actually did the killing. So it's very interesting how they do not get the straight scoop from the Chinese press. I find this very, very interesting. But there's an undercurrent of turmoil in the Chinese populace right now. It'd be interesting to see what effect overall the Olympics has to China. So, Barry, no, it's not better red than dead.
Oh, okay. Better red than white.
Yeah. In the most inspiring thing that I've seen ever, this life was the opening of the Olympics a couple of nights ago.
Yes.
About 4 billion people tuned in to this event. That was really showing what's possible when humans internationally cooperate. It was the most phenomenal media event I've ever seen, and the most amazing example of what's possible us working together as a humanity. There's lots of doom and gloom out there, and with lots of good reasons, supposedly, but in the end, the human spirit has been indomitable. It will win. And love will prevail, and I'm so pleased
I agree with you.
That this Olympics is now happening in China because it's opening a whole new pathway. And I really appreciate that, you're there in Hong Kong, Sigverta.
It's going to change China.
It's
going to change China. We've already seen a little bit of change. Like, it's almost like a police state here in Hong Kong right now. I mean, we've had a lot more freedom until the Olympics got ready. Now they've got 300,000 police up in Beijing. They got, you know, about 20,000 here in Hong Kong just surrounding the Olympics here. There's a great undercurrent of dissatisfaction among the Chinese people. And that guy who killed the American yesterday, he said to his family, I mean, his family, he had to travel about 80 miles to go to Beijing to do this thing. But he said, what I want to know is why did they spend 100 times more on the Olympics than they spent reconstructing Sichuan after the earthquake?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the Chinese people are very dissatisfied with the great amount of money that the Chinese have spent when there's a lot of people starving.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it's going to change China. People are waking up.
Sigvirta, speaking of change and waking up, I feel that there's a great awakening approaching 2012, and I know that's way out there, but do you think that there's any correlation between Ormus and the reawakening of what's possibly going to happen towards 2012?
Yes, I
agree. Is there any correlation at all there?
In fact, I believe that it is. I didn't hear all of your questions. Yes, I believe that Ormus is actually playing a big role in opening people's minds, because people are now conscious of it. And even though, I mean, I don't know how many people are on the forum nowadays. Barry, how many people on the forum? 4,000 or 5,000?
I have 8,500 in my database. I have probably on all of the forums 3,500 to 4,000, somewhere in there.
It seems like it's expanding.
You know, all of these people are, you know, touching the lives of a dozen or more people. So, I mean, the ramifications of it, I believe, ripples through society. And I think it's only going to get bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think a reawakening
is coming.
I still think it's centered
in the U.S. And Australia. There's a great movement for enlightening the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's radiating, and I think it's a good thing. There's going to be a lot more minds changed. You know, I was interested to find out that, you know, 20 years ago, there were only 9 countries that had a Freedom of Information Act where the citizens had the right to know facts about their government. Now there's 70. Okay, there's 70 countries that have either parts of or a full Freedom of Information Act. In other words, the people are becoming more enlightened, and they want more information. They want to know. They want to know what their governments are doing. They want to know if there's corruption. They want to know all kinds of things. And this is the awakening that's taking place.
I feel that it is a great awakening. And also, along those same lines, and you were talking about hydrogen earlier, and I feel that there's a special place of the hydrogen fuel cell that's going to, you know, be part of that. It'd be part of the.
Hydrogen's the fuel of the future. I mean, if you're a Trekkie, I think
the petrol is
hydrogen. Hydrogen is the thing.
I think that the hydrogen fuel cell may be in our near future. Hopefully. What's your take on the hydrogen?
Well, keep this in mind also, that the hydrogen fuel cell could never have existed without the discovery of Ormus. I mean, they're actually using Ormus in its various mineral forms in the manufacture of these fuel cells now. So Ormus is part of that industrialization, moving toward more and more efficiency in fuel cells.
Mm-hmm.
the key ingredient there is ormus.
Well, it's either ormus or the metallic form of the ormus element. There's
right.
not there's no convincing evidence that
but
they're using
you know,
monatoms or diatoms yet, but they may be. And it seems that even when you go to colloidal, a certain amount of it will go into the ormus form.
That's true. I find that very true. Does anyone else have
any other questions?
Okay.
No questions. Just great to talk to you. Great to listen to you again, Sigvirta. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoy doing these,
Excellent.
I'm glad people get something out of it.
Yeah, so. But it's great to hear you, all your comments. And.
Is it too late to ask a quick question?
No, go ahead.
Sure.
I've always heard this, Sigvirta. Have you ever used your ormus with your children or your wife, and what are their perspectives on it?
Originally, my wife thought I was crazy, okay? But she's Chinese, and she believes in Chinese medicine. And she, every meal we have soup, okay? There's some kind of soup. And this soup actually contains ormus every day. So, yeah, my family is getting it. I put a bit of it in all of our drinking water. And I think it makes my children more intelligent. I mean, I think it helps growing children as well. I think it's good for everything it touches, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the foods we eat anyway. And the more we expose ourselves to it, I think the better it is. I think the idea of organics, for example, I don't know if organics are, I know they're more expensive, but organic foods is more of a back-to-nature kind of thing. Rather than using chemicals, we use the natural substances, and all of those natural substances contain ormus. So I think, you know, in general, there is a movement towards more natural, more organic kinds of things, and ormus is natural. And it is, you know, a part of our organic world. So
Amen.
I think a part of this awakening
I've
that you're spoken of.
Salts. I'm sorry. I'll just make another note and I'll be quiet. But I've noticed your bamboo
yeah.
salts mixed with regular Himalayan Tibetan sea salt is wonderful. I mean, you put it in any
yeah.
kind of food and it does have a smell. But it's great. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
The bamboo salt, I recommend that to everybody.
Yeah.
Mixed in with the regular
Himalayan
sea salt.
It's much healthier for you. And, you know, several times during the week, I still use a bit of this bamboo salt myself. And I believe, you know, I believe it helps me remember who I am and what I'm doing. You know, it's so easy in our busy world to get caught up and swept away in the events of the day, the politics, the economics and all that.
Absolutely, yes.
But I think
that's been my latest
another benefit
well,
of wellness
really,
is
yeah.
that it keeps you focused. It keeps a person focused.
Oh, yeah.
I have a request, Sigvirta. Could you provide a definition of ormus
okay.
so we can explain it to other people as an introduction to what ormus is and what we do?
And yeah, it's sunlight, physical, the physical existence of light. I mean, that's my definition. And that brings us back around to where we started, and that is that I believe that it all originates in the heavens as light. And it comes over a great distance to the earth, and it is the building block upon which all elements are ultimately created. Once it reaches its heavy metal state, it goes back extropically to a higher state. In other words, from the one to the many, and then from the many to the one. And that's, and every bit of matter makes that journey.
Another
bonus is a resurrected
PDF that
material.
Had on the Nexus magazine. That was excellent, Barry. Thank you very much.
Sigfrida, has anybody used your...
Thanks for everybody that's here.
Can you hear me, Sigfrida? Hello?
It's a bit scratchy. I can hear you, but it's a bit scratchy. Hello.
Okay.
Hello. I'm here.
Has anyone used your Tibetan seawater precipitate for plants? And if so, what results have they had?
Anybody use my precipitate for their plants?
Uh-huh.
Is that your question?
Yes.
You know, I've had no reports on that. I've had no reports on that, but I would be interested to know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this Tibetan salt lake water is the best I've ever ever found of anything from which to make ornaments. It's the best source material I think there is.
Well,
did I send you some of that, Barry?
You did. It's incredibly concentrated. I can't believe that I get so much ornaments out of such a small container full of what looks like salt water.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. And you know, you have to realize that this stuff comes from an altitude of about 15,000 feet.
Yeah.
In a relatively small lake that's very deep.
And saturated salt solution.
That water that you get from me is exactly I don't do anything to it. It's exactly as I take it out of the ground. And it's so concentrated it will burn your tongue.
Oh yeah.
I mean, this is the most concentrated salt water I have ever seen. It's actually better for making ornaments than the salt. And it's a lot easier to deal with as well because it's clean.
Yeah.
A lot of times there's a lot of dust and particles and debris in the salt because, you know, it's out on the surface of the desert. Whereas the salt water is pretty clean. You don't have to filter it like you do when you dissolve the salt. Anyway, just let me know if you want some more. I'll send you some more.
Do you sell the raw materials? You sell the water and the salt by themselves?
Yes. It's on the website as Chulalama Tibetan Salt Lake Water.
Okay. I'll try it.
And It's had no price increase. Normally, the yields, and it depends upon celestial movements and all, and the attitude of the alchemist, but normally, you can get 4 to 6 times more precipitate than the amount of water you use. And I recommend that when you use this water, it's too concentrated to precipitate as it is. You have to dilute it at least 4, but I usually dilute it up to about 8 times, say 7 parts of water to 1 part of this. In other words, if you get a 200 milliliters of this salt water, then you'd add 1500 milliliters of water to it. Then do your precipitation.
Okay.
And what you'll find is the amount of precipitate out of that 200 milliliters will be anywhere from 600 to 900 milliliters of precipitate.
Wow.
It's absolutely...
What do you use to separate it?
Pardon me?
What are you using to separate it?
Hello?
What material do you use or chemical?
Sodium hydroxide.
That's it?
Sodium hydroxide. Yep. Uh-huh. Sodium hydroxide dissolved in water, but I dissolve it so that the pH is about 15, or I mean at the top of the scale. 14 to 15.
You may want to try adding.
So I use a very strong sodium hydroxide when I precipitate it, and there's a lot of, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of precipitate in it.
I've heard that it's good to add a small amount, maybe 10% potassium hydroxide to it, too.
There's, pardon me?
I've heard that it's good to add maybe 10% potassium hydroxide. You may get a different mix of elements coming out.
Yes. I'm sure that's right. I don't happen to use any of it because I have an abundant source of sodium hydroxide here.
Sure.
I buy it in 25 kilogram bags.
Oh, wow. Well, very good.
I don't think you can buy it in the States for that. Pardon me? Hey, hello?
No.
I've seen it.
Any other questions?
You're so welcome.
I bet it's cheaper to ship
Be
that
careful.
Way.
Be careful, hold your peace.
I bet it is cheaper to ship as the unprecipitated salt than as the, I mean, the unprecipitated water than as the precipitate. Is that
you
true?
You just ship the salt water?
Yeah, just if you
yeah,
ship the...
ship.
Because it's a lot smaller amount, and it's less likely to be influenced by electromagnetic fields.
That's true. And you know, everybody, I mean, I don't know many customs in the world or duty people that object to salt water, whereas they question some of the precipitate.
Oh, yeah.
I think everybody's signing off now.
See, Karen.
Almost 8 o'clock.
No, just
had a couple.
One more thing. What about on the list it said that you were going to discuss the spiritual ramifications of taking Ormus? Have we already touched on that?
I find with the red gold powder every day.
I did a little bit.
Okay. I'm sorry, I missed a little bit earlier, but
listen more.
There was a comment. You find that with
the red gold powder, taking one pinch every day, the kundalini energy spontaneously has arisen twice this week, and it helps me stay above the turmoil.
Oh, wow.
How would you describe that experience? Would it be like you feel like you have energy in your feet, or what would it be?
Oh, no, I've had the kundalini has been awake for many years, but now it rises on its own.
What about somebody who's just starting out? I'm very new at this.
Don't know. I don't know.
Okay. Anybody comment on that?
Well, everyone...
We're unique, just like everyone else.
Everyone has their own experience with it.
Okay.
I wouldn't recommend necessarily that you begin with such a strong product as the red gold powder. I usually recommend people start with, our basic product, which is the Golden Emperor Liquid Sunlight.
Okay.
It's also the cheapest one. We have always maintained, I think, the lowest prices, but that is a good basic broad-spectrum ormus that will give you a feel of it. But it has its spiritual ramifications also. What I think it does is it opens you up to more spiritual what's going on you spiritually in the world. You will hear a WHO sound in your ears first, probably. It's kind of a ringing in your ear kind of a sound if you've never used ormus before. I think that's the first thing most people notice. But after a while, I don't even think about it. I have that sound in me all the time. It's resonating all the time. But it just makes you more aware of what's going on around you. And that is what spirituality is all about. If you are not a spiritual person, you are not aware of other people's feelings, the deeper meaning of what's happening and going on in your life. And I believe that Ormus makes you more aware of everything that happens around you. It's like a brighter light has come on in the room when I'm using Ormus.
And at times,
and so that,
very,
that's
very painful.
Some of the initial spiritual ramifications that happen when you start using Ormus for the first time.
At times it can be very painful.
If a person wants to make their own Ormus.
What did you say about painful?
Question.
When a person realizes what's going on around them, it can be very, very painful in the beginning. I've noticed that I cannot take it at work. I can only take the red powdered gold on the weekends, and being away from the hectic work day and when I take it before work, or when I try to take it during the work day or the work week, it's very, very painful, because you experience what's manifesting at work and what's going on around you. It intensifies that whole, if you're having a bad day or a bad week, it does intensify that.
It does. I agree.
So it can be very, very painful.
Yes,
times.
I agree. But let me tell you something, too. You know, what Ormus does is it does make you more sensitive. It makes you more aware and more sensitive to everything that's going on around you.
Absolutely.
But it also opens your eyes that these things are there. And it gives you a chance to solve a lot of the things that create the tension or the emotion within you. I haven't spoken about the emotions versus feelings thing that or my understanding and theory on that, but, you know, you must become a feeling person versus an emotional person. And what Ormus does in the beginning is it makes you more aware of your emotional nature, and it gives you a chance to readily recognize these things in yourself. So it is a means by which a person can grow by becoming a more feeling person versus a more emotional person. In other words, build out the emotions.
It also makes you aware of where you're at.
Anybody still there?
Yourself and where you're at. And
we're here.
You may need, it shows you where change is needed.
Yes, that's the point. We're all imperfect beings, and we have to learn from our own mistakes, and we have to learn from our own emotional nature. And I think from the spiritual side, Ormus kind of opens that world up to us and gives us an opportunity to make the necessary changes. I see emotionality in a person's life as the darkness, okay? And the light will not come in until that darkness is cleared up. And what Ormus does for a person who's relatively new to it is it helps you recognize the emotionality that you have or the darkness that you have, and it helps you sort it out, solve it, discard it.
Well, darkness isn't really a thing. It's the absence of a thing.
I didn't quite hear what
where
you
I
said.
Where I work is darkness. I work in a dark, deep cave, and it is darkness, and it's a painful thing. So therefore, I cannot take it at work.
Uh-huh.
So I have to make a change, and Ormus has made me realize that it's manifested it quite rapidly.
Very good.
So it can be very.
Now,
very
also consider that you're growing, and you know. Sometimes we need to get out of a situation we've been in the past because that situation is not good for us. And
absolutely.
I do believe
that
Ormus helps us recognize that maybe we're you know, on a different, we need to be on a different track. And anything that makes us more aware of our situation is a good thing.
It is a good thing, but in the meantime, it's quite painful.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, I experienced a lot of that in the early days, too.
Yeah, it's growing pains, yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Somewhat of a newbie.
May I say goodbye? Thank you very much, Pete Verda. I must go now.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Yep. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you very much for being here, and we'll take one last call, one last question, then we're out of here. Speak up, or forever hold your peace, otherwise you're going to wind up right now.
Well, it's me again. I got one last question.
Okay.
Okay, that's fine with me, because I want to go to the organic markets anyway.
I've got a spring that I'd love to make some precipitate out of. It's a spring that's on top of a plateau, but I've got a neighbor 2 miles away that keeps dumping raw sewage from the septic tank service into the sinkholes, and it keeps coming down to my beautiful, wonderful little spring that I want to do something with and make precipitate out of, and I don't know how to go about that because the powers that be don't have any power over this guy and so forth, and it's quite a quandary. So it's a beautiful spring. I lived there for 12 years. We got ran out of there 2 years ago because it just got so bad. But I don't know how to deal with this one person that he keeps dumping septic tank material into the spring. The spring is it's down in a ancient Osage Indian area, and it's sacred to me, and it should be sacred to everybody. But I'm just I don't know what to do about it. It's a quandary for me. I know that Barry's talked about rejuvenating water.
I don't know how to deal with a neighbor that's doing something.
Change the channel.
What I would say is that, Barry, did you say something?
Change the channel. Focus on something else for a while.
Change the channel. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I did. I've done that for a few years, and it's cleared out. It's cleared out really very very nicely, but. The latest news I get is that he's still doing that, and I hated to hear that. I hated to hear that.
Well,
it set me back on channel one.
Whenever you go back to channel one, change the channel again. Get real good at changing the channel. Another thing you can do is boil the water.
Yeah. Well, I've got it bedded. I've got the UV system and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I've got actually two water systems in there now. One 1500 foot depth deep well.
Mm-hmm.
But the spring water is just precious.
Oh yeah.
It's just precious water, and it's all vetted through limestone, solid limestone rock, and it's the best water available.
Mm-hmm.
But
have you tried calling the DEC?
I was going to say the same thing.
I've called everybody. It's
local law,
Missouri Department of Conservation, everybody, and state, county, city, EPA, everybody, and there's so many hands involved in trying to catch this guy, and he has to be caught red-handed. He's dumping porta potty. Particulates, whatever that is, in the porta-johns, the blue stuff, and it comes out in my spring, and it's just, it's a really bad deal. I don't know what to do about it, and, we had to abandon the house, too, and I really want to move back, but I can't until something is resolved.
Continue being a squeaky wheel.
Well, I've been a squeaky wheel. I've been in the paper. I've been in the news. Well,
think positively about it. You know,
brain's cleared up.
Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. In other words, you shouldn't probably do anything because that thing. If he's doing something wrong, it's going to catch up with him.
Yes, it is. It is. He's a meth producer. And all of his friends and and everybody that has any kind of toxic waste, he dumps it in these sinkholes, and it comes directly down to my springs. But, you know, I try not to think about it, and try not to dwell on it, but it's a horrible situation, and the spring is beautiful.
Well, you've got really a great opportunity there, because
Absolutely. It's
so hard, it's so difficult for you to not think about it, that
mm-hmm.
when you get really good at not thinking about it, you will have
mm-hmm.
made a great accomplishment, and it'll solve itself. You've not been able to solve it, right?
Absolutely not. No, nobody can solve it. It's unsolved.
So say you've got two columns on your little spreadsheet, okay? One is
yep.
the things you're going to do. The other is the things that you know you're not gonna ever going to get to or won't ever work. Put that in God's column.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. I've tried to do that, and it's hard, and I go 6 months, and I don't think about it at all, and the spring looks just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And then I talk to the neighbor, and he says, yeah, the guy's still dumping there, and then I just get, you know, I go back down. But the spring is running good now. It's running clean.
Good.
It's running beautiful. It's endangered species of cavefish and
mm-hmm.
so forth. I think they've started to come back, so forth.
You already
but
changed the channel.
It's been a quandary for me because I think that the spring has so much potential. And I want to make, like, I think Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
He had a spring that was taken away from him not recently.
Yeah.
And I think Thomas is down in Oklahoma.
Nope.
It's not too far. He could probably come up here. If my spring was purely clean,
he's in Georgia.
We could probably do that.
Yeah.
Because he's just down right down the road. I think there's a great potential for that spring, and that's why I've held on to it for, I mean, we live in town now. It's still out there, and I think there's a great potential for somewhere along the lines to do something with it. So, anyway, sorry for the babbling.
Don't worry about it.
But I will take your suggestion there, and there's been several other people that suggested the same thing as well.
All right, well, is that it then, Barry?
That's
listen, I'd like to wind the call up. And thank you very much. Are we complete with that one?
Yeah, it's
thank
been
you.
2.5
All
hours.
Right. Thank you
phone,
so much for joining our fantastic call.
I think.
Great call.
Okay, well, thanks very much for asking me. Anytime you have any particular subject matter you'd like me to cover sometime, just let me know a few days in advance. I'm always here to serve anyone who's got any questions about this stuff.
Very good.
We appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank
blessings.
You.
Thank you. God bless you.